What do we search for at Christmas? The most beautiful tree? The perfect presents? Snow? Christmas music? Christmas spirit? Whatever that is. Party invitations? The best food? What do we search for? Quite honestly, and I think you would agree, those are many of the things that are sought after at Christmas, and sometimes by Christians as well as non-Christians. What do you personally look for during the Advent season? What is most important to you? What gains your greatest attention at this time of the year? This morning we're going to remind ourselves of the biblical story of the wise men. Men who followed a new star in the sky and discovered a newborn king. And my hope is that as you and I remind ourselves of that story, that we will be guided to renew our search for the true essence of Christmas before that essence has a chance to pass us by for another year. Please turn to Matthew chapter 2. We're going to be looking at the full text from verses 1 through 12 in Matthew chapter 2. And all of you know the story, but I'm going to remind you of it this morning. In Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, we meet the Magi, who traveled to Jerusalem looking for a newly born Jewish king. Verses 1 and 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." Secular history records for us that at this time, the world was anticipating the birth of a new king. Apparently, there came into the sky at the time of Christ's birth some brilliant star, some heavenly body that had not been there before. And it captured attention for those that were looking. So how did the Magi fit into that scene? Why would they have been interested in this star? Well, the Magi that traveled to Jerusalem were part of a much larger group. They were from an area far to the east, probably Persia of the day. And they were part of a group of extremely wise men. Their wisdom was particularly in the area of astrology, watching the stars and divining things from the stars. And they believed and taught, as did many people in that time, that whenever a new star appeared up in the heavens, it was a sign that somewhere on earth, in some country on earth, a new king had just been born. A little baby who would one day be a king was born whenever they saw that new star up in the sky. This star, however, was special. It was a little bit different. It was especially brilliant, and history makes record of that. It came at a time when there already was a great expectation about the birth of a king. So it's not surprising then that some of this larger group of Magi decided that they would go and they would search this thing out for themselves, and they would follow this star and try to discover who this king might be. The number of wise men from the larger group that went to Jerusalem has been speculated upon over the years. I found it very interesting to learn that the early tradition in the early church was that there were 12, a group of a dozen Magi. It's only in later years, perhaps the last several hundred years, that the tradition has been that there were three, probably because of the three separate gifts that are listed down in verse 11. And obviously the number of the Magi is unimportant, but know that they were part of a much larger group. They were intensely interested in looking into the sky and trying to divine things by looking into the sky. And they were led to Jerusalem by following this star. And as we can surmise from verse 2, they had already figured out that this was going to be a Jewish king. The star seemed to lead them to Jerusalem, and so they made the obvious assumption, given their frame of thinking, well, this is going to be a Jewish king. They had come to see him. They had come to worship him. And it's interesting to note, the Magi were unwilling to accept secondhand information. That was not acceptable to them. They wanted themselves to find this king and be able to give him worship. And so they asked questions when they got to Jerusalem. And although they didn't realize it at the time, the Magi were only 6 miles from Bethlehem where Jesus had been born. The star had led them that close to begin with. We move then into verse 3, and we meet a new character, King Herod. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. In Bethlehem, in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people, Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him. I don't think you need to read through the lines very much to find out that, or to understand that, Herod was more than a little disturbed by what he had been hearing. And on the surface, that would be understandable. Because if you were the king or the leader of a country, and a group of strangers came to you and wanted to know about the one who had been born king of the Jews, you would wonder, where is this coming from? I'm king. How can there be another king? So that much is understandable. However, Herod had an obsession with suspiciousness against other people. And that's recorded for us in the record of history. He was convinced that others were constantly after his throne. He was so obsessed with it that at various times throughout his rule, Herod had people killed just because he was convinced, whether he had proof or not, he was convinced that they were out to get him. Some of the people that he had killed because of his fear included his wife, his mother-in-law, and 3 of his sons. He was obsessed with thinking that everybody's out to get me, everybody wants my throne. And every king in that day had some reason to fear because there were always people who would try to kill a king and take over. But his fear was rather extreme. At the time we are coming into the story and he hears about the question the Magi were asking, he's been enthroned for 30 years and he still doesn't feel any security even after all of that time. To say the least, Herod's a little bit out of balance when it comes to protecting his throne. The question that had been asked by the Magi, we find in verse 3, was very disturbing to Herod. But it wasn't just disturbing to him, it was disturbing to the people as well. And I can't help but read between the lines here as well. Herod did not initially talk to the Magi. He heard the question. And that suggests to me that out of his concern for his throne, Herod probably had informants well placed throughout the whole city. And when some strangers came into town to ask the question, well, where is the king of the Jews, the newly born king of the Jews, the informants came to Herod, and he was disturbed. But we learn that the whole town was disturbed. I wonder if Herod himself didn't cause some of that. If he didn't try to cause an uprising against the Magi and against this message that there might be a new king. I suspect he may have had something to do with it. He tried to get some answers. Herod would have understood a little bit about the Magi question only from the standpoint that he was half Jew. And being half Jew, he would have heard at least a little bit about the prophecies that there's going to be a Messiah or there's going to be a Savior. He wouldn't have been unfamiliar with that concept. So he called together the Jewish chief priests, he called together the teachers, and he wanted some answers, so he asked them the questions. They quote from Micah, and they say, Bethlehem is where this Messiah is to be born according to prophecy. I'm rather disappointed that when Herod called these chief priests and teachers together, that there's no indication that they had any excitement, that they had any inclination, well, maybe this is the Messiah. They just seemed to be performing their duty in answering Herod's question. They didn't seem to have any interest in whether or not this might be that very Messiah. They gave a clinical answer. Maybe they were no longer able to hope much in the promise of a Messiah. But they gave Herod the information, and after Herod got the information, he goes a step further. And he decides, well, maybe I need to talk to the Magi. And the text tells us that he went and he secretly talked to the Magi. Secretly is the word, but in my mind, the concept would probably be more easily conveyed or more appropriately conveyed by the words sneaky or conniving, because that's really what Herod had in mind. He wanted to get some information from these men so that he could further protect his interests in the throne. He was already planning, I believe, how he could beat this newest threat. He found out the exact time that the star first appeared. And that may not seem important, but it was, because it was part of Herod's plan. It was very important to him. Later on, when Herod gave out the decree that all young boys were to be killed, he used the timing of when the star first appeared to decide what age range of boys to kill. So that was an important bit of information to Herod. He sent them on, the Magi, he sent them on to Bethlehem to find the child. The last message he conveyed to them was, well, when you find this child, come back, because I too would like to worship this child. And I'm sure that as a king for 30 years, he had a way of sounding very convincing. I doubt if the Magi were able to see that he was not genuine. Murder was on his mind. And he wanted the Magi to help him in his plan and in his plot to save his throne. So the Magi leave, and in beginning in verse 9, they come and they find the Christ child. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of frankincense and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. For those of you who have not previously had your bubble burst, the picture that you see every Christmas of the shepherds and the Magi all gathered together in the manger around the Christ child is not an accurate picture. We see that from several hints in the text here. The star led them to a house, not a stable. The star led them to a baby, no longer a baby, a child now. The child and his mother were in the house. Jesus is anywhere from several months up to as much as 2 years old at this time. It's taken them quite a long time to travel from when they first saw that star. So the true picture is the shepherds on the night of the birth and in a house later on with the Magi. Verse 10 tells us that they were overjoyed at what they found. Remember, they had traveled a long time and they had traveled a long distance. I don't think in their wildest imaginations they understood the significance of the birth. But it was important to them because of their interest in astrology, their interest in the stars, to have found this king, and they had been successful. So they bowed down, they gave him worship, and they gave him honor. And then they brought out some gifts, specifically given to a king-to-be. And the symbolism of these gifts is sometimes speculative, but it certainly is interesting. There was the gift of gold. Certainly considered the gift of a king, a precious substance, a valuable substance, a very appropriate gift to give to one who will one day be a king. Incense, or frankincense, as some of the versions translate it, that was a substance that was part of the formula for sweet perfume that was used in temple worship. I'd like to read a few verses out of Exodus chapter 30 and see how this was used. Exodus chapter 30, verses 34 through 37. Exodus 30, beginning at verse 34. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Take fragrant spices, gum resin, onycha, and galbanum, and pure frankincense, all in equal amounts, and make a fragrant blend of incense, the work of a perfumer. It is to be salted and pure and sacred. Grind some of it to powder and place it in front of the testimony in the tent of meeting, where I will meet with you. It shall be most holy to you. Do not make any incense with this formula for yourselves. Consider it to be holy to the Lord." The priests, in going through this process that was prescribed by God through Moses, did their work as a mediator between God and man. And it suggested that frankincense ought to remind us that Jesus is that mediator between us and God. And he's obviously not literally incense, but in a sense he is, because of what Christ did for us. He offers up a sweet-smelling sacrifice to God. Frankincense, a second appropriate gift for this particular king. And then the third gift that is mentioned is the gift of myrrh. Myrrh was a spice that was used to embalm the bodies of the dead, and was used even upon Christ's body. We might turn over to John chapter 19, where we have record that this particular spice was used upon Christ's body. John chapter 19, beginning with verse 38. John 19, beginning with verse 38. Later, Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly, because he feared the Jews. With Pilate's permission, he came and took the body. He was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who earlier had visited Jesus at night. Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds. Taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it, with the spices, in strips of linen. This was in accordance with Jewish burial customs. It is suggested that the gift of myrrh is a gift to specifically remind us of the death of Christ. And again, for this particular king, that's an appropriate remembrance and an appropriate gift. So the gifts of gold, incense or frankincense, and myrrh are the three gifts that we're told were given by these magi to Christ. And then finally, in our narrative back in Matthew chapter 2, the last thing that we discover is that God knew the true intent of Herod's heart, even though the magi probably did not. And through a vision or a dream or some kind of communication, God let the Magi know that they were not to go back to Herod. They were not to go back to Jerusalem. They went back to their hometown and probably willingly shared their news with the other Magi that did not accompany them. But they didn't go back to Herod. They didn't communicate with Herod again. That's the story, and most of you know that story very well. Now that we've been reminded of the Magi and their part in the Christmas story, I'd like to suggest briefly some ways in which you and I can apply the story to our own Christmas celebration. And I've entitled this part of the sermon, rather than calling it the application section as I usually do, I just say, we search for Christ in Christmas. Because I think that is a goal that would be good for us to set for ourselves, that we will search for Christ in Christmas. And we ask several questions. The first is this: how hard are we searching to find Christ in Christmas? You know, the Magi had to work very hard to find this new king. I don't think they understood the significance of this particular king, but nevertheless they worked very hard. They came many, many miles. Their journey probably took at least several months. And once they got to Jerusalem, they had to ask some questions and they had to travel to another city. But they were willing to do it because they knew that it was important, in their way of thinking, it was important for them to find this king. What lengths are you and I willing to go to find Christ in Christmas? Thousands of Christians in our country and around the world see so little of Christ in Christmas, they don't celebrate the holiday at all. And maybe some of you know people who make that choice not to celebrate the holiday. I don't necessarily advocate that position for everyone, but I do believe that it is a sin to celebrate a Christless Christmas if at the same time we give lip service to the idea that it's a Christ-honoring time of the year. And I think we need to be very careful there. I want to encourage you to do whatever it is that you need to do to make sure that Christ has a place, that you find him in your Christmas. It could be very simple. Maybe individually or by households, you take the time to read through some of the appropriate scripture passages early in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark and Luke. You just read through some of those stories to remind you of what this time of the year is all about. Maybe you take some time to quietly listen to Christmas carols, refamiliarizing yourself with their words and the meaning of those words. Quiet time that refocuses your attention upon the season. Maybe every morning between now and Christmas, before you really get going for the day, you just simply say to God, God, I thank you for your son. I thank you for this time of the year, which forces me to remember him in his birth. I don't think it takes a lot for us to keep Christ in our Christmas, but that little that it takes, we must do, or the season will pass us by and we will have missed Christ during Christmas. The second question, do we see through the false search of those around us? In the story, in our passage today, Herod claimed that he wanted to honor Christ. He claimed to the Magi that if they would go to Bethlehem and find the child and come back, that he would go and worship Christ as well. His claim was a lie. The Magi may not have been able to see that, but certainly God did. Herod had no interest in really honoring this child. Many people feel like they have really captured the essence of Christmas, the true essence of Christmas, when in fact they probably have not. In fact, almost certainly have not. Christmas, and I want you to hear my whole thought here before you react to it, Christmas is not primarily a family time. Christmas is not primarily about giving gifts to show appreciation to others. Christmas is not primarily about helping those who are less fortunate than we. Those are certainly very good things, and those are appropriate things to have be part of our Christmas. But those things must sit upon the foundational essence of Christmas, and that is Christ. Without Christ as the primary focus of our Christmas, there is no such thing as Christmas. We deny the very meaning of the word Christmas if Christ is not the foundation. I don't suggest we give up some of those things that I mentioned. I just suggest that they have their appropriate place and that Christ is the foundation. And neither do I suggest that you and I judge other people because we don't feel that they are appropriately celebrating Christmas. I would suggest that, number one, when we observe that and we feel that someone perhaps has Christ out of balance or out of the picture in Christmas, that we first of all be careful that we don't get caught up in that same false search. And that number two, as appropriate, maybe we suggest to them that Christ does have a greater part in Christmas than they have allowed. And we certainly have to be judicious in how we say that and when we say that. But we can do those things without having to judge other people's motives and other people's feelings. We need to see through the false search that many make at Christmas. The third question is, what gift do we have to give Christ at Christmas? The Magi brought very appropriate and very costly gifts to honor the one that they believed would one day be a king. What gift do you bring? What gift do you have that Christ would want? And this is really so simple. More than anything else, this Christ, who's not a baby anymore, who's not even a child anymore, as in our text today, longs for us to give him of ourself. I think he longs at Christmas to be Lord over every part of our lives, that everything that we do, whether it's at work or home or wherever it is, that everything we do, we allow him to control and him to guide, to let him have rule in our lives. There's nothing more valuable that we can give to Christ than our heart and our soul and our mind, just everything that we are. And in the end, what's interesting is if we give those things up for Christ, we end up not really giving up a whole lot, because he gives us back far more in return than we could ever possibly give to him. As you search to make Christ a part of your Christmas, just remind yourselves and give yourselves over again to Christ, allowing him to be Lord in every single aspect of your life. And then a fourth question. Will we hear a message when we find Christ in Christmas? The Magi found a child king, not knowing that it was Jesus Christ or would be Jesus Christ. The Magi found that king, and they received a message from God. In their case, it was a message that they were to avoid Herod, and they were to go back to their home country in another way. They did follow God's communication, though they certainly couldn't fully comprehend it. In a different way, if you and I will intently search to make Christ part of this Advent season, I think we'll receive a message in return. Maybe several messages. Primarily, we'll rediscover that Jesus Christ is the center of Christmas and that he must be the center of our lives. We'll be reminded that in Jesus Christ is God's greatest gift throughout history to mankind. I think that we will find once again, if we really have found Christ at the center of Christmas, we'll find once again that there is meaning and significance to life. And not just life in general, but my individual life and your individual life. As you rediscover Christ again this Christmas, know that you have significance and value as an individual person. If we do make this intense search and listen carefully, we'll discover some of these messages and many more, and we will make Christmas a Christ-honoring season in our lives. In this particular Advent season, as in many previous Advent seasons, a multitude of people and a multitude of things cry out for my attention and yours. Even very good people and very good things. In the midst of it all, my greatest wish and my greatest prayer for each of you, as well as for myself, is that we will search for Christ in Christmas, and that in doing so, you and I will once again focus upon the one about whom we claim he is the reason for the season.